In the 20th century, those who have attempted to philosophize in the grand manner, the process philosophers, the idealists, the personalists, and the phenomenologists. Now, in phenomenology, we see one of the major attempts to recover objectivity, that is, to have a philosophy that affirms a world that's independent of our beliefs about the world. In addition to phenomenology, an attempt to recover objectivity is seen in realism and in logical and linguistic analysis. Someone who would not be interested in objectivity but would be interested in being scientific would be a pragmatist. But pragmatism has a mitigated concern because it's not trying to answer the traditional problems of philosophy. It's trying to reconstruct philosophy in a more practical direction. The existentialist that we've talked about today obviously have a mitigated concern because they don't think there is any public universal answer to anything. Everything's subjective individualism. Existentialism can be seen as a degeneration from the phenomenological analysis of consciousness. So phenomenology is an attempt to recover objectivity, doing philosophy in the grand manner. Existentialism is kind of a falling away from that into private subjectivism. Now, as we turn to logical and linguistic analysis, that is not a school of thought that tries to do philosophy in the grand manner, the classic questions, and develop a whole system of thought. But it is an attempt to recover objectivity, the notion of a world that is independent of our beliefs. In the first portion of what we're going to be looking at as linguistic or logical analysis maintains that language should be purified, or we should find an ideal language for expressing whatever we wish to express that is true. As the ideal language approach disintegrates, proves to be impractical, if not impossible, certainly not successful. As it disintegrates, what will come along is what now is called ordinary language analysis. It too is analytical philosophy, but it's not looking for an ideal language, a formal language, to express our truths. It rather says we ought to be content with our ordinary language and coming to understand how it works. And so, ordinary language analysis can be seen as a degeneration from linguistic analysis or logical analysis of the ideal language sort, a falling away from it, similar to existentialism's falling away from phenomenology. Or another way I can put it is, ordinary language analysis becomes it's a parallel, and remember that means there are going to be differences too, becomes the parallel to pragmatism, in that we want to look at what we're actually doing, what we're actually saying, and try to become more successful in following the procedures and ridding ourselves of artificial problems created by impractical questions raised by philosophy in the past. And I'm just trying to give you a scheme for the 20th century so you see some of these interrelations. The analytic tradition, now to come to our topic, the analytic tradition, you need to remember, is going to have two phases. The ideal language phase, early on in the century, roughly to 1950, let's say, and then the ordinary language phase rather than the ideal language phase. And so it's important to distinguish those two phases, but as I start, I want to talk about the analytical tradition in general, what is characteristic of both of these phases. It has been said that the analytic tradition in philosophy resurfaced with George Edward Moore. G.E. Moore. There was certainly an analytical tradition in philosophy prior to G.E. Moore. What's fascinating, though, is that the analytic tradition virtually dies out at the time of Immanuel Kant, and you don't hear very much of it at all in the 19th century. It's almost like here's this philosophical tradition that went underground. It's like a river that now goes underground to the 19th century. And apart from certain phases or themes that might show up here and there, Peirce, for instance, says some things that are like analytical philosophy. But apart from those passing indications, you don't have a real healthy revival or a resurfacing of the analytical tradition until we come to the method of G.E. Moore. The analytic tradition in philosophy can be seen in David Hume, before him John Locke, and before him we could go back to Hobbes. But of course after Kant and the accession of idealism on the one hand, which says that all of the objects of knowledge are constructed in some way by the mind, and the non-cognitivist approaches of the 19th century, the analytic tradition was not healthy and alive. And speaking of the analytic tradition, we want to acknowledge that there are big differences among philosophers who are all doing analysis. To use Wittgenstein's way of putting it, the later Wittgenstein, we'd want to say that those who we call analytical philosophers bear a family resemblance to each other. A family resemblance is not one trait that every member of the family has. Isn't that right? If you get families together, you see a family photo, you can see how everyone in the photo belongs to the family, but it's not one thing that you're seeing. It might be the way the eyes are separated, you know, how narrow or how wide the separation is for some, but not everybody shows that feature. Between certain members of the family, it may be kind of their noses look the same, or the same color of hair, or the same height or something. But in a family, what makes people obviously members of the family is not necessarily one thing. And what makes philosophers members of the family of analysis is not altogether one thing. But they do have a family resemblance to each other. And that's what I'm going to be trying to describe here in my introductory remarks about analysis. Perhaps the chief characteristic in the family of philosophers who do analysis is an outlook on the universe that it's made up of independent and a large number of independent entities. And that these independent entities are loosely and separately related to each other. Or to use the language, the more technical language, they have external relations to each other. Now you all understand this, don't you, by now? This is the opposite of Hegelianism. Hegel says everything is internally related, right? Because everything is a matter of thesis generating its own negative, its own antithesis, and then healing the breach with a greater synthesis. So everything, in one way or another, is internally related. The analytical school says no, reality is made up of things that stand apart from one another, independent entities. They are externally related. They are loose and separate. This is in line with, again, your cultural upbringing. I would just take it for granted that your orientation is that that you are you and I am me, not that we are all together. We may choose by an independent decision on your part and my part to be in this room at the same time, but we are really quite separate. Now, it's more than just social and interpersonal theory we're talking about. What makes up the universe is a matter of separate entities, too. And from that assumption, you can see why analysis becomes important in philosophy. The primary task of philosophy is to take the complex entities that we encounter and experience and do what? Break them down into their simpler parts. You do analysis when you take the complex and break it down into its simple components. And the reason why you break things down into their simple components is because once you get down to the most simple, then what you're expecting is you'll have clarity. Because you can directly understand that which is simple. Think about the way we use language. Many of you have probably said, either out loud to me or to yourself, I wish you could make this more what? Simple. No one has ever said, oh, I wish he could make it more complex. Now, why do we use that language of make it simple? Because we all expect that the reason why we have trouble understanding something is its complexity. If I could take this complex thing and break it down to its component parts, then it would become simpler. And that's a purposeful ambiguity here. Simpler? Well, simpler not only as to its construction, but it becomes intellectually simpler too. So the analytical tradition is made up of philosophers who have this general outlook that reality is made up of separate individual things externally related to each other, and if we want to understand the world, the procedure should be to analyze, break complexes down into simples, because when something is, quote, simple, then you understand it. It stands before you, if you will, in total clarity. Now, I hope you have a real sense for how this completely changes the direction and perspective of idealistic thought. Did Hegel want to be analytical? Did he want to break things down into their simple components so now we can have clarity? No, in fact, Hegel said every time you have something that is loose and separate, you don't have clarity. You have an inner negation that comes from it. The only way to gain clarity or truth is to do what? To build things up. So you go from the thesis to the antithesis, and then you need the synthesis, but then you need another synthesis for that one, and on, until you finally have absolute spirit. Then we'll finally get clarity, when we have absolute spirit. And so the analytical approach is the very opposite of idealism. Idealism says, keep building things up. Look at the context. See the bigger context. Get a bigger context. Analysis says, take that context, break it down, break it down, break it down, and then you'll finally get clarity. And so how do you explain things if you're an idealist in terms of the absolute context? How do you explain things if you're an analyst in terms of the component part? Please get that in your notes. I mean, I know we're going fast today and this is a lot of stuff to digest. Hopefully at home when you reflect on this, maybe the coin will drop and you'll say, yeah, that helps, Dr. Bunsen. I can see that. Of course, as you know, I'm following W.T. Jones and his summaries here, which I find very helpful as well. The analytical tradition changes the direction and methodology of philosophy. Philosophers in the analytic tradition highly value clarity. Let's get clear about what we are saying. Most of us would have to admit that most of our experience in this world is anything but clear. Listen to Jean-Paul Sartre explain experience and that oozy denseness about everything, you know? Experience is not clear. One event flows into another. One state of consciousness oozes into another. We're not real sure how to distinguish things. Truth and error run together in our thinking. The world's a mess. There's this big complexity and it all runs together. Analytical philosophy says we need to get into that and find some clarity. Get away from the fuzziness of our thinking. As Dr. Bahnsen, I've not tried to do it as a matter of pride, but as Dr. Bahnsen displayed his analytical personality thus far in this course, what happens when we finally get bogged down with phenomenological jargon or all of this pomposity of Hegel? Eventually the analyst says, you're not helping at all. That's not clear. We need to be more exact. We need to be more precise. Are you getting my point? Analytical philosophy, as I said, begins by seeing the world as made up of loose and separate individuals, things. And the method, secondly, is then to analyze complexes into their simple components, because that's how we gain, thirdly, clarity. Because once we have analyzed things down to their simplest component, then we are directly in the presence of what is real. Not the difficult, complex reals, but the simple reality that everyone can understand. To put it another way, once you've analyzed something down to the most simple, there's nothing else needed to explain. Because explanation takes place by dividing things up and explaining the parts. Once you get down to the lowest part, the atom, the indivisible unit of reality, there's nothing left to explain. And so the analytical tradition seeks direct confrontation with the most simple component of thought or reality.